Good afternoon. How are you?
Great. Doing well. How are you doing, Joe?
I'm pretty sick right now, but it's good to see you. So my
I'm really
voice,
sorry about that. I will do a lot of talking and save your voice.
it's fine. I've actually been saving my voice for today,
Oh,
so
good.
for this conversation. So I'm gonna give it the old college try, see how it
I'm
is.
glad to hear it.
Thank you. So for people who don't know who you are, do you want to give a quick intro?
Sure. I'm Jess Haberman. I'm currently director of product content at Anaconda. And I met Joe when I was a senior acquisitions editor at O'Reilly Media. I was in publishing for the first 14 years of my career, and then moved into tech. Sort of the devil you know versus the devil you don't. It was an interesting transition, and I've really enjoyed my time at Anaconda doing a lot of different stuff. So I did a lot of work on our learning platform and sort of running our education and DevRel teams, and now I'm back into head of content. So the content has been my first love, so I'm excited to be jumping back in there.
What do you like about content?
Well, I just like that there's it seems easy, especially when you have when you have tools like GPT, ChatGPT and things like that, other AI tools, but actually requires a lot of work and a lot of understanding of your audience and a lot of finesse and a lot of I'm finding, especially in this role, really developing relationships with people, and understanding what their needs are, and just be able to give them some sales enablement or make sure we get a good like blog post with a partner and stuff. You really have to understand where they're coming from. You have to have the right voice. You have to have, the right perspective, the right details, the right delivery method. So that is very, very in line with my publishing background. So it's fun to get back into that.
That's really cool. And I think before you at O'Reilly, you actually did what was it, outdoor guides or something like that.
My first publishing gig, I worked at what was called Globe Pequot Press. They're now Roman and Littlefield, and they have an imprint called Falcon Guides, which if you do outdoor stuff, you might recognize them. If you go to like a national park, store, you'll see they have yellow covers, yellow bindings. And so I used to work on, hiking, camping, climbing, fishing, surfing, all these like really cool outdoor sports guides, and learned a lot about the national parks. Back then, I was so broke, publishing paid nothing. So I didn't get to go anywhere. So it was like the way I learned about the world and the way I learned geography, which was great. And then, once I, finally started making some adult money, able to travel to some of these places like I had read about for so long,
That's
which
super
was great.
cool. Yeah, it's like, oh, there's a more to Yellowstone than Old Faithful, so you probably knew all
Yes.
the fun places there. Yeah, I actually used to have some Falcon guides back in the day. I think I can't remember if they're climbing guides or books by climbers like John Long or whoever it was.
John Long, yes, I used to work with him frequently. He was my Joe Reese of like my early career,
Oh, tell me more.
He like I mean this in a very nice way, but he needed a lot of attention. He needed a lot of guidance. He needed to chat every week, and so and it was a really rewarding relationship. I got to like really help him. He, unlike you, was like very gruff and very loud and very kind of intimidating. But we that relationship grew into a point where like we worked really well together.
Oh,
But
that's cool.
took a lot of like negotiating with him to like just develop earn his respect and like and sort of get to a place where he could trust me as an editor.
Yeah, for the audience here, John Long was a rock climbing legend back in the 70s and early 80s. I think he was part of the was it Stone Masters, I think it was the original group. Yeah, so yeah, definitely OG, and how you describe him being gruff, aggro is definitely we I got to know him too. He's a cool dude.
John
So
Long is
anyway,
awesome, though.
yeah.
I really miss working with him. I'll have to send him this podcast so he'll know
Well,
what
I,
we're
you know, yeah, you get me now. So it's the Walmart version of John Long. So
That
or the Dollar Tree version. I'm not sure which one.
That's
But
awesome. Well,
that's
like John
awesome.
Long, you also have a best-selling book. So hey, I mean, you're in good company.
It's well, it's, and we climb. It's about the only things we have in common.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool. So then you got into O'Reilly. Was it your first like tech publishing gig?
Yeah, it was. I didn't know anything about O'Reilly when I
joined. Interesting.
I was not technical. I was sort of savvy, you know, like I helped sort of managed. I did a lot of our like kind of tech, quote unquote tech tutorial stuff. Just helping people like on board with, I don't know, like SharePoint and, you know, in our book, you know, management system and things like that. Just helping people, like just helping in training and learning. Learning's always been like, my background and stuff. So being sort of tech savvy, being a quick learner, being curious, being enthusiastic about, you know, I had taken some computer science courses in high school and college. Oh, wow. I even thought about like minoring in computer science, but I was an English major. So I was already spending a lot of solo time even back in the day when we used computer labs. So I was doing a lot of, you know, writing. So to tack on a minor in computer science and spend more time, solo time in a computer lab coding, I was like, this will never work for me. Like, I'm a major extrovert. It was like not going to happen. So I didn't like go that far down the computer science track, but I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed like the problem solving. And I've come back to it. I've done, back then I was learning like C++ and Java. And so I learned some Python and was into it. I picked it up pretty easy because it's pretty similar, you know, to Java in a lot of ways. So, you know, the sort of general constructs are, you know, you kind of carry over if you can remember that far back.
Oh yeah, I remember that far back. That's pretty cool. I didn't know that about you. That's really cool. Then you get into tech publishing, and I guess that's sort of like getting a minor in computer science.
It totally is. I mean, so at O'Reilly, I started in like my topic area was product management and UX design, and I didn't know much about either, but neither are super technical. So it was a useful way to sort of onboard into technical publishing and learn from my colleagues and things like that. And I did that for about probably 4 months or so. There was an open role for an acquisitions editor to focus on data engineering and to some degree data science, but it was heavy data engineering. And that is much more technical, but I was asked if I wanted to move over. They really needed someone in that topic area, and it was an exploding space. So it would have been so dumb not to move in there.
Yeah.
So I remember going to Strata like really shortly after that. And
what year was this?
This was 2019, probably.
Okay.
March of 2019, I want to say. And that might be right. Or it might have been the fall before. I forget if it was. No, it was in March and in San Francisco. And I remember sitting down with a lot of people, but like Dean Wampler and Holden Corral, and just being like, I know nothing. Talk to me like I'm a fifth grader and tell me what you're present. Like, what is your presentation actually about? And like, walk me through why it's important. And, you know, what are the trends you're seeing? And then you start picking up patterns with all the conversations and start to see. And like, it was such a fruitful conference. I probably signed like 10 books out of that, those couple days, you know? I miss that conference a lot. It was such a great way to get all those people together and to have just a lot of really useful conversations that wasn't super vendor, you know, focused and had kind of people from all over. And I got to meet like, you know, a lot of the real stars in the space. I was really lucky to develop relationships with all of those too.
That's super cool. I never went to Strata, unfortunately, and then it it's now defunct. So
it was a good show.
You mentioned two words I'd like to get back to: acquisitions editor.
Yeah.
What is that?
Yeah. So a lot of folks, when you think of an editor, you imagine them doing a lot of like grammar or fixing and things like that. But an acquisitions editor kind of stands at the front of the process and is really focused on building a list, a publishing list, and is thinking about what kind of talent they want to bring in on books. Typically, it depends on the publisher, but a lot of technical publishers, like, you know, the topics you want to sign, you have a hit list, you know, pipeline, and then you're going out and finding talent to fill in, you know, on those topics. And often the topics will shift a little bit depending on like the talent and what the author and what they want to cover and their background. And then often you'll get proposals out of the blue that might be worth looking at. And, you know, I know you and Matt approached O'Reilly with, you know, your own plan, and Helen Nelson, she did too. Hers came from, you know, off the transom. There's what we call like the slush pile, like hers, like she didn't even have a connection to anyone necessarily, an editor. So hers just came in through like the general submissions inbox. Very rarely does anything come in through there that's worth looking at. And hers was great. So, you know, I got a call with her to be like, okay, yeah, let's work this out. And then versus, I think you guys, you know, kind of get the next step where you find someone. I think you work through like Matt Harrison to find a connection.
Yeah, Matt gave us intro, I think, to Rebecca. And she's like, well, I don't really deal with this kind of book, but I know someone who does. Meet Jess. And so that's when we met.
Yes. So I credit her all the time with giving me that book, but because we did work really closely together, but she was really focused on AI machine learning.
Yeah.
So she sent it my way. And then, you know, we talked through the process and everything, and ultimately, you know, worked on a great book together, which is awesome.
Oh, thank you.
So acquisitions is like, a lot of some publishers, you do acquisitions and development of the book. And some you hand off to a development editor. So at O'Reilly, we did have development editors in house to hand off the book to, and still stay closely involved throughout the process, but you're not doing a lot of the like actual moving things around and changing, you know, wording and things like that. We do that on the front of the, like the proposal stage. We do a lot of it there. And then you've got a plan, you hand off so that the development editor can follow that.
And mentioned two more words, book proposal. this will segue nicely into the main topic of the discussion. But a book proposal, why in this day and age would anyone need to write a book proposal? Why don't you just start writing a book? Why don't you just,
question.
I mean, what's the purpose of a proposal?
So a proposal does a lot of things. And I think it depends on your publishing goals, but even if you don't care about a traditional publisher, you know, right away, you just want to throw something up on Amazon and self-publish, you are going to have a hard time if you don't know your market, your audience, like who this is for, what the competition is, like how you're going to stand out, especially if you're self-publishing, because nobody else is going to help you do that. Yep. Amazon is not going to help you. They will probably hinder you in a lot of ways to make your book, you know, rise to the top. So making sure you know exactly who you're writing to, that you should know what page length you want. You should know what price point you're looking at. You know, and if you're working with a traditional publisher, they will help you on all these things, but you should have a pretty persuasive pitch in terms of what your book is, why it's different, not why it's completely different and nobody's ever seen anything like it before. It should be related to something out there so that you have some sort of, you know, numbers and statistics to build on to say like, hey, this book, you know, has 300 reviews. This was clearly a really popular and well-read book. And mine is on a similar topic, but what this author doesn't do is X, and I'm going to do that. And then yada, yada. In tech, commonly the, it just needs frequent updates. So there's always opportunities to like, to bring something new and more relevant. But you gotta persuade with a little bit more than that, especially if you want a publisher to sign on to your project.
Yeah. And I guess as an acquisitions editor too, like the, sorry for the audience, I have a pretty bad cold, lost my voice. What do you look for in a good book proposal? And I guess maybe another question is how are you incentivized as an acquisitions editor?
Oh, not really. Just pride, really.
Pride. Okay.
We get some sort of decent salary, and then like, you know, I think like, you know, you're building your list, so you're what you publish and how it performs. You know, it ends up helping helps your reputation greatly within the house and oftentimes outside of it. Certainly helped me when I had successful books with people who liked working with me. That helped me build my network. You know, that helped me, you know, get folks to sign on to ambitious projects that maybe they wouldn't have if they didn't hear that, oh, Jess is great to work with, and you know, oh, you should talk to her or whatever. Yeah. So that's incentive. That's great. Building my network and meeting people in the space who are experts and who, you know, where we could help each other out. I think that's really important, is like, mm-hmm. there's win-wins there, to get on the topic of negotiating. You know, so that incentive is sort of there, you know, in terms of just like growth, and learning. And, and the kinds of things I'd want to see in a proposal is that it's clear. It's, that the writing is good. It doesn't have to be fantastic. Like, I'd rather you have a really good idea with, and you need some help writing, than, you know, you're a really great writer with like no clear, you know, the idea doesn't work. Just like, it's not fully fleshed out. Being able to stand out in the market, that you've clearly done your research, that you know what the market is, you know who else is in your space, that you've had a lot of conversations with people. You know, if you've got a good network, that certainly helps. That certainly like help you guys. So there's a lot of different ways to be successful in terms of your proposal, but there is this like, you know, je ne sais quoi about like having a commercially popular idea, and mm-hmm. and that can be really hard to like understand how to hit that. But I think you talk to folks like Matt Harrison or folks who have published a lot of books, like they've clearly kind of figured it out. So it's great to see they can be really successful once they sort of figure out the process, and he's done a mix of self-publishing and traditional publishing, things like that, and in other types of content. So I used him as an example when I gave a talk at Day-to-Day Texas, just because you know, building out a range of formats and delivery methods and ways that you can kind of share similar messaging is a really good way to kind of build your career as an author and to negotiate better deals in the future. So you kind of make yourself really an appealing author to work with when you do stuff like that.
Yeah, I think Matt's he's sort of the benchmark that I use for tech content creators in terms of book writing and course development. He's the guy's a machine. And constantly cranking out stuff. I look at his site, I'm just like, of course, on everything. It's crazy.
Yeah, he is prolific. But he has a niche, you know, like he has a few different areas where he kind of builds on his own expertise. So so once you find your area, it's great to like build out in different versions of that and a little bit around it, a little bit within it. So he's done that quite well.
So we'll use our book as an example of the book proposal and the negotiation process. And so so Matt and I were originally approached actually by another publisher I'm not going to name. And we're like, okay, that's cool. Let's shop this around and see what we could do. You know, I think the potential for this, for the idea that we had for a book, probably wasn't the best fit for that particular publisher. And okay, maybe it's a fit for O'Reilly, right? So you know, I call Matt Harrison actually, and which is like, hey, make an intro. And then I made an intro, got connected with you. I think the first thing you said was, hi, let's do a book proposal. I think we also introduced ourselves, but I think the walk us through that. So I think as far as I recall, the first step was book proposal. Mm-hmm. But before that, even, right, I'm sure when you're on a call screening the author, like, what are some of the things you're looking for?
Yeah. Well, I think you did two things right. You shopped around and you didn't just accept the first publisher. It can be very appealing to do that because it's a lot less work than actually shopping it around, getting feedback, having to change your plan. You know, that is a lot of work. And then you found someone, you know, you found a way to get a direct contact at the publisher. That was also the right thing to do. So you made use of your network. That's a great sign, because it means like you have a network. You know how to like, you know, get in touch with the right people. You know how to get, your needs met. So that's helpful. Certainly we do a little digging on our authors before we meet them. It was clear you had a big network, and so that was like, okay, they're obviously worth talking to. Knowing generally you were talking about data engineering, that was a thriving topic, that it still is, but that was at the time was really, really good timing. So there was a lot of things that sort of aligned to sort of further conversation.
Yeah. And obviously Matt and I are very charming and great to talk to. I'm kidding.
You were great to talk to.
No, thank you.
Well, you took direction. I always like that in an author,
Well, that helped.
You were ready. We did a lot of work on the proposal before we got agreement to move forward and got you a contract. And different editors work differently. Not everyone goes that far into the proposal process or gets into that much detail. But knowing how ambitious this book was, I really wanted to have that sewn up before, because I knew that I was handing it off to someone and I'd have very little control at that stage, or much less control. So wanting to kind of have it all buttoned up, like, this is our clear plan. This is what we're all agreed on. Because sometimes if you don't do that, there's some, mistranslation of the plan or the approach, or things get moved around and then the acquisitions editor doesn't know. And that can be complicated. So having that all buttoned up, spending that time on the front end to do that, I think, is really helpful. The way I worked as an editor.
Oh, you were tough. I'm not going to lie. I mean, it was one of those things where I think, cause you use the word ambitious, and I think you sort of, you made Matt and I sort of double check ourselves. Like, are we going to be in it to do this book? Cause it's not the typical book.
No.
Right. This is not, it wasn't going to be like data engineering with Python or whatever kind of book. Like, this is, trying to define a field from first principles. And I think the big gamble for you was, and I'd love your take on this, but it felt like, okay, so who the hell are these two guys, first time authors, trying to take on a project like this? Do they know what they're getting themselves into? Are they going to pull it off? I think it's a fair question. I mean, there'd be times we get on calls and it's like, Matt, I don't think she likes us, man. I really don't.
Well, I think it takes a lot of just gut, getting people, and I can be harder on people who I think get me and who I think we have an open conversation. I can be honest with them, and that will motivate them. So that was the vibe I was getting from you guys. People and teacher. I mean, it works. Teachers like they want to, they want to do good. They want to, they want to get straight A's, that sort of thing, So I felt like we had the right kind of vibe to for you to handle, critical feedback, and that it really helped make your book better. I think the things that, though I was taking a gamble with first time authors, you were already very well known in the field. Had a big network. That was huge. And that we already had Martin Kleppmann's book, Designing Data-Intensive
Applications.
Applications. Thank you. Yeah. Complications.
Complications.
That was a book that had sold extremely well, was probably still our top seller, even though it was 5 years old at the time. It was a really, really popular book. It was on some data engineering adjacent concepts, but there was room for another big book in the space that had, was in similar in terms of sort of a focus on fundamentals and less on tools. So the gamble paid off for sure. All the stars align there for sure.
Oh yeah, it seemed to. And then, I think with us, I'll walk through how you felt the negotiation process. When I think the book proposal itself, when we're going through the structure of the book, there's a lot of back and forth. I think, there are points where you were pretty adamant. There are points where we were pretty adamant. I think we eventually came to an agreement on it. But I felt like in terms of the, the tactical stuff, financials, my impression at the time was, okay, we're two first-time authors, we're unknown. We don't have a lot of room to negotiate here, probably as much as we, if we're second-time best-selling authors or whatever, probably a different story. But the fact is, it's like Matt and I were just like, okay, we're stoked to work with O'Reilly on this. Or we're glad they've taken a gamble on us. And, to some extent, we're taking a gamble on them too. But I felt like we weren't in a position to say, well, you know, yeah, that's nice, Jess, but you know, we need to triple the royalties here and you know, carve out some of the backside as well. You know, so I didn't feel like we were in a position to, you know, at that point to leverage
anything. And that's mostly true. I think you, no matter your experience, you all authors should feel like they have permission to negotiate. Even if you're a first-time author, there is literally no harm in asking for more. And that doesn't, I mean, one, I think you want to know what your goals are in publishing. Like, the money might not make that much of a difference to you, but maybe the timeline does, maybe the title does, maybe the order of the way the book is structured, maybe the way in which it's, you're going to sell it. Like, maybe you are on a like big speaking circuit and like you want to sell books at every one of your talks. You want to negotiate like a system by which you can get, you know, either you have a like, so you can do a lot of things. You can potentially negotiate your like author royalty, and you can get a better, sorry, not your author royalty, your discount. You can get a better discount on books that you buy yourself. Yeah, because if you're going to sell them yourself, you actually make a lot more money than your royalties. So, you know, if you want to, if you have that system already, or if you want to develop that system, then you can totally, you can do a buyback like that. You actually, if you do a buyback, you can get better royalties. So like,
explain a buyback.
So a buyback is like, and I haven't done these for a long time, but where basically you commit to buying a certain number. Say you're like, I'm going to buy 2000 copies. Mm-hmm. You inventory them, you keep them in your own house, your car, whatever. But you get, a really nice discount on those. And it helps, publisher get to a break even number. They can offer maybe an advance, or they can offer maybe a better royalty, because you know, that just their financials are working better because they already have like a guaranteed sale. So a guaranteed like non-returnable sale. So that sort of thing can really help. It doesn't matter whether you've been an author before. If you have that, if you want to do it, which it's like, it's a lot. Do you really want to hang on to all that inventory that might never sell? That's a gamble too. And like, do you want to, you know, slub them around everywhere? That's another thing. But if you're, you know, you're like, I'm going to have speaking slots like twice a month, you know, all year long, like it might be worth it. There's all kinds of things that you can negotiate that don't have to be your royalty rate. But yeah, as a first time author, our standard royalty rate was like 10% net. And that was pretty much what we offered everybody. If you had written a book before that was successful, yeah, you could get a little bit more than that potentially, you know, depending on the state of the business and, you know, what the goals were with the book and what we expected to sell and things like that. But I really want to encourage authors always to ask. Like, there's no harm in that, especially female writers, females, whatever you're doing. You know, I frequently find that they do not negotiate. They don't negotiate their salaries. They don't negotiate, you know, like any kind of like book offer or you know, any fees that I'm paying. Like, I very, very rarely do women come back and ask for more. So I want to always encourage people to ask, like, cause there's really no harm in doing it. I think there is a very like understandable fear. Like, I think it puts you in a uncomfortable place to ask someone for more money especially when you're trying to build a relationship with them. That feels icky. But it's there in a case where you're talking to an acquisitions editor, in the case where you're talking to a hiring manager or a recruiter, they expect you to negotiate. That is a full-on expectation from that in that relationship. So when you don't do it, you're leaving money, or you're leaving something on the table. And it doesn't have to be money. Like, it's vacation. It's like, it's whatever. It's like, you know, we talk about buybacks. Like, so there's a lot of different things that you have control over. And like every, you know, you're generally, whether you're trying to get a job or trying to get a book deal, like the person on the other side wants you to be happy with the deal. So they're going to make an effort. You know, they might not have a lot of opportunity. I think in publishing, this isn't common in tech publishing, but if you are thinking about writing fiction or nonfiction, You might consider getting an agent. Like an agent is going to help you have that negotiation conversation. And then, you know, so some of the like harder stuff is done by someone else. You know, you're going to end up paying 15% of your royalties to someone to help manage that and help manage the relationship throughout the process. I think, you know, you can argue whether an agent is worth it. I think in technical publishing, it may or may not be. There aren't a lot around in technical publishing, to be honest. So so I don't feel like you, if you didn't get an agent, you missed out, because you probably didn't. In that, like, numbers don't move that much. So it was just like not even a lot for an agent to make on a lot of tech books. So that's why I think that's why you don't see a whole lot of them. But yeah, you have advocates. You know, you can have someone like look over your contract. Like, that's okay. Like, you know, ideally they've looked at a publishing contract before. You can always tell when it went to a lawyer who had not seen one before, and then it became like a pain in the ass. But like, you know, protect yourself. That's important. Like, you know, we negotiated things in contracts all the time. So yeah. So, you know, but again, pick the thing that matters to you. You know, if you know you like want to, like, you don't want to work in July or whatever, like, work that into your timeline. But you got to hit your deadlines to like then have that happen. So there's going to be protections on the publishing side too.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I think the, and I will say to the audience that royalties don't matter until they do, and your book is actually successful, then you start wondering, why didn't I ask for more money? But it happens, you know, and that's life in the big city.
Real money in publishing comes from publishing a lot of different products. Like, it never comes from one product. But it's like a starting, you know, it's the starting gate to like publish, you know, another, and you've done this too, is like publish a course, like, you know, like do a podcast, like put, you know, publish like, you know, a blog, like do, you know, you can find other ways to monetize your content, publish another book, you know, and then you get a course and a podcast and a blog out of that. And like, you know, you start to build this whole ecosystem of content, and then all together, that's what's really valuable. It's your whole brand that's valuable. It's not huge. Like one book necessarily.
The one book is hard. I always heard like from other authors, I was listening to a podcast and I've heard this repeatedly, but it's like, it's your second and third books that sell your first book.
Yeah.
Right.
That's very true.
It's hard for your first book. I think like what happened with Fundamentals of Data Engineering, I think was definitely an exception. Like I think people ask me how you can replicate that. It's like, I have no idea how you would ever replicate that.
Luck. know, certainly a lot of talent too. And again, your network and the timing and all the things, all the stars aligned. But yeah, it takes a confluence of events for all the things to go right for you to have that successful of a book.
And even now I can tell you the pressure on the next book I'm writing, it's like it's a real thing. That's why I'm publishing in public, actually. It's just so I can like get all the cobwebs off the thing before it actually goes to print. So it's just get it beaten up in public. Because I will say, like, once your books, you know, and that's when we did the tech review for a book. I mean, I hired, but it, you know, had like the bench of just like the most vile people I could think of. The great people, but vicious.
I hope they're not listening. Goodness.
Well, you're vile in the best way possible, but like just people who like wouldn't hold back on any criticism, you know, and just would beat the living crap out of you. So I figured, you know, it's better to have that happen now than on Amazon. And the thing is, you will get bad reviews. People will hate you no matter what. So that's just the reality of it. But yeah, it's an interesting one. The with the negotiation process too, I was actually helping a friend of mine, you know, with her, was looking over a book agreement with her, with another publisher, a few months ago. And yeah, that had some crazy stuff. Like, you know, if you weren't reading it carefully, you would have missed it, but it's like, oh yep, you have to buy 1,000 copies of your own book.
Oh yeah. It was like, that's interesting.
Yeah. Cause it's like, okay, so they're giving you an advance, then you got to go pay probably, you know, $20,000 or maybe more. To buy these books. And I'm like, okay, do you have room in your house for this many books?
Yeah.
I was like, get that thing out of there.
That's real sneaky. If they don't tell you that up front, like, you know, there are some publishers where they call it like a hybrid model where you're paying for certain things, you're offsetting some costs, but they are also still fairly selective in terms of like who they publish. I hear about this more often in fiction than I do, you know, nonfiction or technical, but yeah, you know, and I think actually they do quite well these days because fiction publishing is like impossible. It's really shrunk. Agents are, it's really hard to get attention. I mean, I've been shopping a novel for, I don't know, a couple of years now. I don't even remember. And I get few responses. I've only got interest from a couple people who, you know, ultimately didn't, you know, sign on, but, it's just been like so demoralizing. I'm like, I know I'm a good writer. Like I know right. I'm a good writer, you know, I know what a book's supposed to look like. It doesn't mean that like I'm like God's gift by any means, but you know, and it is a different area of publishing that I've been. So I had to like really learn a lot. But yeah, it's very humbling that it is. I'm very empathetic to folks who are trying to get stuff published and have it, you know, really struggling and are not getting the attention. So, you know, I think often publishers, you're going to find a more, if you can find the right publisher for your topic, I would go straight there and try, yeah. You know, again, like try to get a connection there. But then you can kind of, if you decide you want an agent after the fact, you can always get one or you can always try.
Yeah. I think it depends definitely on the type of, book you're writing too. Like I definitely agree that tech, I mean, it might be more trouble than it's worth, I suppose. Mm-hmm. Depends. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's only
an agent like helps you with the negotiation, reviews your contract and understands publishing contracts and what to look for. And then, you know, helps to manage things. It's sort of the liaison. So if you start getting behind, like you've got someone on your side to be like, oh God, I'm afraid to tell the publisher. I'm way behind where they think I am. And they can have that conversation for you. If you're like, especially if you're non-confrontational, sometimes it's nice to have somebody like be there for you and just like kind of help, you know, just help, you know, make compromises and things like that. And then you have somebody who can kind of give you advice around marketing and getting the word out on your own and can push the publisher to do more in terms of like, yeah, marketing and promotion and distribution. So I'm not sure that they do all that much. Like, I don't know that the difference is significant enough to like pay the 15%, depending on the book. If it's a novel, yeah, it certainly does. Because you're probably not going to get noticed by the big houses if you don't have an agent. It's very, very hard.
Probably not. Yeah. And I mean, I think, you know, I think for the writing I want to do going forward, it's, after this book and maybe another one, it's also on data. You know, for me, I'd like to branch out probably into some, mm-hmm. you know, the bigger picture books, right? Or kind of more mm-hmm. businessy type stuff. And that's going to be a different ball game at that point. Now you're
so much harder. Business books are really hard, and they and it's impossible to break into if you're not already like very well known. So and like there's just so many like very generic books out there. And there's like a lot on similar topics. So getting mm-hmm. noticed is really hard. And they want to know how you're going to sell it. You like they expect you to be on the circuit speaking frequently and selling your mm-hmm. own book. So it's it is a different model. It can be very lucrative, but mm-hmm. it's hard. It's definitely a different.
Oh, yeah. Different. Yeah. I expect I'm going to have to do it just through just continuously writing on the topics in public and building the base that way. Yeah. Because authors I've spoken with like Shane Parrish is one of them. I mean, he had his blog Farnham Street for years and then, you know, was able to get some best-selling books, you know, published with the big publishing houses. And I think Morgan Housel is kind of similar. He's having his own content, and, you know, then having a Wall Street Journal best-selling author. But it's like, that's hard. That's, mm-hmm. you know, you want to talk about it, difficult. You know, you're like Michael Jordan at that point or whatever. It's a different game.
Totally. So, totally is.
Mm-hmm. So back to negotiation, like, what are some of the things that you wish authors would know about that you've dealt with?
Well, you know, it was a lot easier for me when they didn't negotiate. but it sort of made me sad, like, you know, that they try, like, I, you know, or in some cases, like, I was super prepared for a whole negotiation fight, and then they, like, they didn't do it. I was like, oh, okay, well, that's easier. Didn't need that budget, you know? So, you know, it's, so as an author, you know, it's build your relationship with your editor so that when you, you know, and if you're doing that and they really like you and they really want to work with you and they think like, oh man, I have to get this book. And that helps if you've got competition, if like, oh, another publisher is looking at this. If you get your author really fighting for you, and then you know that, like, if you have someone else, another publisher looking at it and they're interested, and then you know, you're like, okay, O'Reilly, I really want to work with you. Here's the thing, you know, I got this other offer from another publisher. Like, what can we do about this? Like, they're going to give you more money. Like, they're going to try. So like, that always helps if you're like, if you're serious about like playing the two against each other, which sure you should. So that certainly helps.
But let me ask you this though. What if I'm shady and I just make up something like, hey, I'm talking to, you know, Manning over here and I'm talking to O'Reilly. Like, did the acquisition editors talk to each other?
I don't think so. I think we would say, great, okay, tell me what's your offer. You know, and we would ask for all the details. You'd be like, yo, what's your advance? What's your royalty rate? Is it net or is it list? Is it like, you know, like, so you'd have to really start backing it up with some answers. I mean, sure, you could go in there and lie, but they know you're not coming from Manning with like a 25% royalty or something like that. That would be, we know generally what our competitors are offering, what their sort of window is.
In the funny circumstance for you, where you're at Anaconda now, actually, you're working with one of the editors that we talked to back in the day, right? So it's a funny confluence of events where I think we're all having drinks one night, and I was like, crap, this is comical.
It was so funny because I had no idea. I knew he was from that publisher, but I had no idea that he was the one talking to you guys. And then you told me, and I was like, oh my, and he knew I stole the book from him, but like, I did not know it was him. So it was hysterical because I had already hired him, was working with him for a while.
Oh,
and
he's hilarious. Awesome. Oh, he's great.
It's a small world for sure. But you know, I think it all went pretty well in the end.
It went funny. Yeah. So all I'm saying to the audience is, the world's very small. Just do things by the book. Don't be shady.
Exactly. So.
That's cool. I guess, you know, kind of, what do you think the rise of AI is going to do to the book publishing industry?
I mean, I think there's going to be a lot of, you know, not great content out there. I think in some ways it's going to help. So here's an example. And this is just, I was at my writing group last night and it occurred to me. So there's another gentleman who is querying now, and he's like, it takes so long to like research who I'm supposed to be, you know, querying to, what the agent's good at, if they're, you know, if they're looking for stuff in my genre. And then I've got to put together he's written a query letter and it's quite good. But I've got to tailor the query letter for this guy. And then I've got to go through the form and then I got to fill in all the things. And it takes an hour just to query like one agent. It's sort of like writing a job application and, you know, sort of the old fashioned way and like filling out all the things, doing the resume three different ways. So I was like, man, is there an easier, faster way? And I've definitely used ChatGPT to come up with other versions of my query letter. None of them were better than the one I had. So if I was starting from scratch, I think actually it might help me get there a little faster. Writing a query letter is a very weird, hard thing to do because you got to summarize your novel piece of nonfiction in a way that's like very like commercially interesting, and you got to like be very brief. There's like specific structure they're looking for, and you got to mention competitive titles, and it's got to be related to what the agent's looking for. I mean, it's complicated. But I thought, okay, well, what if I could give ChatGPT my query letter and ask it for a list of agents that I should send this to, based on what they're acquiring? So I did that. The first five it sent me were ones I had already sent my query letter to. So it was very, it was like, you got the top five in the space already. Damn. Great. I asked for 10 more and it gave me a bunch of new ones. There were some I knew, there were some I didn't. So I was like, great. This like actually gave me something I can use. Like I can see who's open for queries and I can try reaching out to them and do a little more digging. But like, that's the hard part. Like there was a whole book, like, I mean, you know, hundreds of pages thick, called Writer's Digest, that would tell you like what agents like queried in what topics, and you would search, and it was published every year, and you would go and look it up. And now there's like other databases and things like that where you can find that stuff. But like, wow, the AI like has that information and you could find it. Like, that's great. I think generally, in terms of content, there's going to be a lot of AI generated content out there. I still think high quality content is going to stand out, but I think it's going to be harder to get noticed, especially if you're not publishing with like a well-known brand, like a Falcon Guides, like an O'Reilly Media, that's like immediately visually recognizable. You know, I mean, that's why people on Amazon put, you know, silly birds and things on their covers or trying to look like O'Reilly, you know, so being able to align with a publishing brand, in my opinion, again, I'm super biased because I come from branded series publishing. I think that's going to help stand out when there's a lot of sort of AI generated crap out there. But I think good writing will help. And if you use AI in smart ways, like, it's going to help you, you know, if you can be more efficient, if you can write faster, if you can, and like, go ahead. If you're working with a publisher and they allow you to use AI tools, use them, you know, in whatever way makes sense for you. If it helps you outline, if it helps you sort of like distill things, if it helps you with your grammar, like, why not? You know? Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I am like just a forever optimist, overly optimistic all the time. So maybe I don't see the the sort of disaster that we're hurtling towards, but I think there's good opportunities to use AI, and that it's not a great writer right now.
Kind of sucks, actually. Mm-hmm. I think I tried. I was like, early on, I was like, okay, let's see what it can do. So I had it generate some blog posts. I was like, these things suck really bad, really, really bad. So I mean, on one hand, I'm kind of glad that, you know, that the bar, at least a barrier to entry, I would say, because if you're a good writer, I think it actually means less competition in some ways, because people are just going to seek you out because they want good ideas. They don't just want to read a LinkedIn contributed articles all day. Those AI generated crap fests that are out there. I think they're zero purpose, but that's another story. But it's interesting. But I think from the perspective, I think for authors though, right? It's like they, if you already have a brand, I this is where I kind of question the publishing model. Cause I think one reason I'm going off of my own is I felt like, okay, so the publisher did, I think, a great job at having a recognizable brand on their own. But the thing is the publishers don't help the authors market typically. The onus is still going to be on the author to do a lot of that work. And I think if you have a strong brand, there's actually some interesting ways you could take it these days. Seeing some, good success on Substack, for example, and podcasting and all these other mediums where you have to build all these other components, like you're saying earlier, like this is the fence of just various content. But it's reaching a situation where it's, the labels will still definitely provide that stamp of approval. Like, you know, this has been vetted, for sure. Mm-hmm. But in the sea of noise, that's where I'm kind of wondering, like, what happens is because having an O'Reilly book, for example, doesn't mean it's going to be a great book. There's some great O'Reilly books. Yeah. There's some terrible O'Reilly books. I mean, this is true with every publishing company, no matter what. So
I'll say a couple things in that I think publishing being like marketing from your publisher being the publisher's value has for a long time not been the value. You know, it's really been distribution. So O'Reilly is going to get you into like every bookstore. They're going to get you on every bookshop, like every, you know, virtual internet bookshop. They're going to get you into used bookshops. They're going to get you into libraries. They're going to get you like, you know, basically everywhere. To do that yourself is a lot It's a lot of work, and there are going to be a lot of areas you don't have access to. They're mm-hmm. going to get you translations. They're going to get you audio. Like, so you, they help you distribute your books into all the formats and all the places that you want to be. And that's the very hard thing to do on your own.
And then
O'Reilly has their own, like, you know, their learning platform too. So that then they have a lot of help there. And then the other thing I would say is that, you know, I was in a very good space for, you know, data engineering was, you know, it's a really popular topic area. We had very few books that didn't break even, you know? So, and I think a lot of it had to do with the brand and the topic and the timing. But that is, you know, I generally say a rule of thumb is like at most publishers, a third of books are never going to break even. They're going to lose money. A third of books are going to break even, and then a third of books are going to sell, you know, sell and hopefully make up for the rest of the ones that you gambled on and lost. So it's an interesting time for sure. I think we'll all see, you know,
Amazon, I mean, I you know she talked about this when we were back in London, but I mean, that's when they announced their, 3 book per day limit for authors. And I was like, holy crap. Like Amazon is already a cesspool of whatever. And it's just going to get far worse. You know, I mean, there's not a day that goes by I don't see a new knockoff of my book.
Yeah.
There's fundamentals of data engineering books all over the place. And, you know, they just keep popping up.
I'll make a plug for bookshop.org. That's the only place. I mean, other than like Target, that's the only place I buy books. I'm not a big audio fan, but like I'm excited. I did listen to an audiobook recently on Spotify. So I'm excited to see them there. I don't shop on Amazon. So, you know, I'm always looking for alternatives in terms of like where I buy anything. Finding books elsewhere, even I'd rather spend it at Barnes and Noble or even Walmart than Amazon. But yeah, bookshop.org is great. I find almost everything.
That's a good plug. I think maybe the rise of generative AI too. It might mean that physical books actually come back. I mean, I know that you know, the survey I did was 55% of people actually liked physical format, but I think people are just going to want more authenticity, and that's one of the reasons I'm doing what I'm doing with the Substack is about building the audience around the idea too, right? So you have thousands of people that are, you know, hopefully tens of thousands soon, where they bought into the idea, and now you have your tribe, right? And that's kind of what I feel like the future is going towards because. There's just so easy to crank out just drivel with a ChatGPT.
Having a built-in audience, having a network, absolutely. Regardless of, you know,
generative 20 AI
years
or not,
ago, yeah. 20 yep. years ahead of time, it's going to help you. And for people to care about what you think. So having a podcast audience, for example, is key. Like that's really going to help people. And in most authors are not good at it, you know? So I think that's where, you know, folks like you and Matt and Matt Harrison, you know, really stand apart and being able to find like different ways to like build your community and network.
Yeah. Well, awesome. It's been fun chatting with you as always.
You too, Joe.
Yeah. I'm glad you can understand me, hopefully.
Hope you feel better too.
Thank you. Yeah. It's going to be so much fun. For people who want to learn more about you, how can they find you?
Sure. Come find me on LinkedIn. It's probably the best place. And right now doing a lot with Anaconda. We've got a lot of really cool things coming up. If you're a trainer and you'd like to help us develop Python training content, please let me know. We'd love to work with you. And I'm still actively building out our educational resources on our platform. So, or just, you know, just hit me up and chat.
Yeah, you're very approachable. So
thanks.
That's awesome. Well, yeah, thanks for your time, and we'll see you somewhere in the world. So
I'd love that. Thanks for having me.
Anytime.